Завершение саммита Большой двадцатки Владимир Путин ответил на вопрос.
Лицо рассказал Владимир Путин.
Поединка Владимир Путин вышел на ринг.
Владимир Путин принял участие.
После того, как Владимир Путин не поехал.
For more than a decade, he's been dominating the airwaves. Prime Minister Владимир Путин said this. President Владимир Путин did that. Prime Minister Владимир Путин criticized this. President Владимир Путин signed that. And for months now, we've been hearing his name chanted derisively on the streets of Moscow and other cities. Putin must go. Russia without Putin. Putin is a thief. Tsar Vladimir, the indispensable man, the undisputed master of a vertically integrated authoritarian system. From his splashy debut on the scene more than 12 years ago, when he famously vowed to rub out the Chechen rebels in the outhouse, Putin has been the alpha man at the epicenter of Russian politics. So it's not surprising that as opposition to the current regime spreads, the focus has largely been on Putin personally. His leaving the scene has been seen as a necessary precondition for any change. But how central is Putin really? And how centralized and vertically integrated is the Russian political system? Is Putin's departure necessary for change, or can Russia change with him? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
An interesting polemic appeared on the web this week that, to be honest, inspired the theme of this week's podcast. Alexander Goltz, editor-in-chief of the liberal online magazine Ezhednevny Zhurnal, published a column in which he suggested that Vladimir Putin's vaunted power vertical was breaking down. Goltz wrote that top officials, like investigative committee head Alexander Bastrykin, had gone rogue and weren't even listening to Putin anymore. The serious cracks in Putin's power vertical are now apparent, Goltz wrote. A day later, Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, a once and future guest on this podcast, wrote a rebuttal in his blog suggesting that Putin's power vertical was never really what it was cracked up to be after all. Russia remains a fragmented state with power organized in networks and circles rather than vertical structures, Guillory wrote. Putin is more a creature of the system than its owner. He concluded that the opposition's fixation on Putin was actually counterproductive. In order to ultimately go beyond Putin, Guillory wrote, one must get over him. My take, which I've written about in the blog numerous times, is that Putin has become Russia's indispensable man because he is the system's arbiter, a trusted broker who has been able to forge consensus among the elite's competing interests and clans. They don't trust each other, but they all trust, or at one time, trusted Putin. But today's indispensable arbiter could easily become tomorrow's very dispensable leftover once he loses the trust of a significant portion of the elite, which Putin appears to be doing now. Kirill, when we were speaking off mic yesterday, you told me you have another theory about the nature of the Russian regime today, and I'm dying to hear what it is, so let her rip. What do you think?
First of all, we have to define what does it mean, authoritarian regime. We have a classic definition of this. Authoritarian regime is the regime where the ruler or kind of elite is controlling the political and ideological sphere in the country. And economical sphere, economic, is more or less independent, and especially social and private life of the citizens are absolutely free, or with some limitations, they are free. Mm-hmm. This is the classic authoritarian regime from
a free market type.
Let's begin from Kemal Atatürk's Turkey in the 1920s, and then all these authoritarian regimes.
Pinochet's Chile.
Yes. Before the war, the Second World War, we have three authoritarian regimes in the Central Europe. So in Poland, mm-hmm. in Latvia, in Romania, then in Hungary, mm-hmm. Then General Franco's Spain, mm-hmm. Then after the war, Perón in Argentina, and so on. So, of course, there are a lot of differences between them, but the main rule is that the ruler, the ruling elite, is controlling totally, absolutely, the political and ideological sphere. And they have kind of ideology. It could be nationalistic, as in the case of Turkey, for instance. It could be Catholic and anti-communist, as it was in Franco. It could be quasi-socialist, as in Perón's case, and so on. But this is the rule. What did Putin, or what she produced or made with Russia in 12 years from 2000. He invented, a kind of new type of authoritarian regime. It based on the total control of an economy. Not on politics, not on ideology, but on economy.
Doesn't that necessitate control of politics? It's hard to control an economy if you don't have political control.
Yes, but it's a very good question. So the focus of the authoritarian regime is changed from the politics into the economy. You know, mm-hmm. And that is the most important thing, and the most important, you know, division between the authoritarian regimes of the classic modern age mm-hmm. and the authoritarian regimes of our times.
Let me interject here just briefly, because Putin, I agree, he did establish control of the economy, specifically, the energy sector. But he also eliminated the election of governors. He also emasculated the Duma and turned it into a farce of a parliament. So he did also take control of the political structure.
Some of it, but not all of it. And there are two various questions. First of all, the political sphere, and the second question is ideology. Mm-hmm. We'll back to ideology in a few minutes, mm-hmm. and let's focus on political sphere. He was controlling the political system, not at all, but anyway. He turned the elected governors and so on into the kind of bureaucratic procedure mm-hmm. of appointing them and so on. But anyway, if you want to oppose Putin's regime in today's Russia, you can do this. Mm. More or less
today.
Yeah, and it was 2000.
But what about in 2007 or 6 or 5?
You could do this. You just mentioned Alexander Goltz. Alexander Goltz wrote all his opposition articles from 1999 till today.
They allowed safety valves. They allowed things like Echo Moskvy and Yeshidevny Journal and things like that to operate to kind of let the air out of the out of the system a little bit.
Yeah, it's more sophisticated. Yes, it's more sophisticated control. Of course, they tried to control the political sphere, but as I told you, the focus is on economy, not on politics. Mm-hmm. This political control is kind of byproduct of the full control on the most important parts of Russian economy.
Is it a byproduct, or is it a necessary precondition to have at least some political control, and more importantly, having the law enforcement bodies completely under your control?
In this case, just answer the question: what is all about? Or is it's about power, or it's about money?
Money is power.
No. In Russia case, money, and once more money. Money instead the ideology, and that is the question, and that is the answer. That's why I'm speaking to you that this political system, this power vertical, you can call it whatever, but. Anyway, it's about money, it's about economy, it's about the full control on the oil industry and so on. And all these things with political control is just a byproduct of this activity. You can do this if you, for instance, control Duma. And mm-hmm. okay, in this case, I'll control Duma. If I don't
So political control is a means to an end, is what you're saying.
Yes.
what, let me ask you this, what is the source of Putin's power? Because if you look at, there's different theories about this. The very simple power vertical theory, if you will, has Putin at the pinnacle of this pyramid, controlling things through bureaucratic and administrative methods, right? Sean puts forth that there's these different concentric circles of elites, and which I generally agree with. And I, what I would add is that Putin's source of power is that he's the arbiter. These different clans don't trust each other, and they trust Putin to be the fair and honest broker in the system, much like a like 19th century Britain almost, you know, to balance the interests and keep one clan from getting too strong and balancing all of their interests. This is the source of his power. In that sense, what you're putting forth is the source of his power is control of the economy. But my question would be, if that's the case, why Putin? Why not Sechin? Why not Sergei Ivanov? Why not Patrushev? Why in this sense, any one of these people is interchangeable? There has to be something that's been special about Putin that's made him the front man for all of this.
I'm afraid we're playing the kind of alternative history game because it happened. Putin. Yeah. Putin appeared as a head of a state in 1999 and then in 2000. And mm-hmm. that is all. And then this game began. Mm-hmm. And I cautiously agree with you and with Sean about the role of Putin in this system. Of course, he was a broker. He was a broker among or between various very important and powerful clans and so on. But what is interesting and what I think it's absolutely new in this year, for instance, and I think in the future it will go on, that Putin is changing his role. He is trying to change his role of a broker. As an agent, mm-hmm. you know, as an affair agent in some mm-hmm. sense, in the connections or relationships between various powerful clans in Russia. He wants to become not a real ruler, not a real authoritarian ruler, but maybe a kind of, you know, a major player in this game.
Well, he has been a major player in this game.
I'm not sure because what we saw and still see, the game what is playing for us, it's mm-hmm. playing on the screen, TV screens, and right. on the in the text and the
we
on
see
the
Pakazuka.
Internet. Yes, well, up to you, simulacrum. Yeah, and no one. I am not claiming that I know everything about the inner life of Kremlin and so on, but. We can just propose that, suppose that something is going inside Kremlin's walls and so on, and the signals from there show us that Putin, of course, he is main player on the public scene. Yeah, you know, but I'm not absolutely sure that he is so on this in this inner circle. But he's a little bit, and I see it. He's a little bit annoyed with the situation. I think all this game with Medvedev and so on. One of the main consequences of this decision to return to the power last year was their utter annoyance of Putin of all what happened after that. Mm-hmm. He tried to just to play the same game with the same rules and so on. But something is out of order.
Yeah, and the game changed during yes. Medvedev's presidency. And this is Medvedev's legacy, which I've argued yes. again and again.
And that's why I think Putin wants to be a major player in the inner game itself. Too.
So he wants to move away, because let me see if I'm understanding you correctly. My understanding of how this has always worked is that Russia's ruled by, as it always has been, by a collective leadership, basically. We've called it many things. Putin's Politburo, the collective Putin, the deep state, whatever, what have you. But it's been this dozen or so insiders and maybe a couple dozen more on the periphery of this circle that have basically made all the decisions. And Putin, and again, this is where Putin has been the broker. Seeking peace between whatever, Sechin and Kudrin, whoever yeah, yeah. and finding the compromise that everybody could live with. His very decision to leave the presidency in 2008 was the subject of a negotiation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There were people like Sechin that wanted him to stay. They call the Party Третьего Срока, the party of the third term. But he didn't go with them. I'm wondering now if he regrets that decision, to be quite honest.
Who knows?
But you're saying now that Putin is moving away from this Politburo model and more into almost a monarchistic model.
Not monarchistic. We'll discuss this. But once more, he is very disappointed of the public reaction of his decision to return. And he thought, because he never thought in terms of public sphere or public politics, no. And so
he
on.
He didn't have to. His
popularity carried. He is absolutely disconnected, and he is very involved in this inner circle. And he, I think, I can just suppose, he is very disappointed that something is happening outside this inner circle, and
it sure is.
Yes. and then the next step, the next logic step, that someone there in inner circle just provoked all this situation in the public sphere, mm-hmm. And that is, I think, the most important reason of his disappointment. And this is the initial point from which he began to move in January and then mm-hmm. February, or with this all silly speeches and with all these threats,
this
and
populism.
And so on. And I'm absolutely sure that some people in the inner circle in Kremlin, they're very disappointed with this behavior, because they are not about the populism, they are not about the communists, because populism is another side of the public sphere and public politics.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't want to play this game, and they cannot play this game. And
it's a dangerous game for them,
yes,
considering that they
sure.
control most of Russia's wealth.
Sure, don't forget that Communist Party is very powerful in Russia.
Yeah.
Still very powerful in Russia. And playing with populist ideas and so on, you cannot just get away the communists and to leaving their ideas there.
They could create a Frankenstein monster that they will not
sure.
be able to control. That's,
sure.
That's the risk.
And I am absolutely I agree with you that this deep state, I love this the
nice.
Definition. Yes, it's very good. And this deep state is a little bit, stressed with the mm-hmm. situation. And this is, I think, the source of maybe future, maybe recent division inside the Kremlin circle. Not about the liberalism or, Navalny or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the rules of the game.
Then the rules of the game are changing right now.
Yes, they're changing, and Putin is changing his role. And another thing, and I'd like to draw your attention to this, all this, especially Western terminology, when you're speaking about Russia, Tsar Vladimir,
mm-hmm.
Tsar Yeltsin, and so on. There is a very grave, a very serious difference between authoritarian regime and monarchy.
Now, you realize I was speaking ironically
yes.
when I referred
yes.
to him as Tsar Vladimir.
Yes.
Trying to provoke you, actually,
yes,
which I successfully
I'm not
did.
Taking you, but it's very important to understand this thing. Mm. It's not about monarchy. It's not monarchy. It's based on the authority of the hereditary dynasty.
Of course.
And any monarchy is based on the kind of balance of the interests of various groups of population.
In the course, in the population, yeah.
Yes, but authoritarian regime usually he is founded or based on one. Sometimes it's middle class. Sometimes, but anyway, it has to be based on some powerful class. As it was in Latvia in 1930s, as it was in Poland and so on. For instance, in Poland, it's peasantry and mm-hmm. Catholic clergy mm-hmm. and so on. So this is another part of the problem and another part of this game or in the inner Putin circle. They try to, based on something,
mm-hmm.
not on populism. Previously, they based on so-called middle class. Now it is disappearing. So now
they were a victim of their own
yes,
success. There,
yes, yes, and now they are in desperate search for some other sources of their strength.
Is there a social basis for it? Can they find it? Is it there to find? Do you think?
I think it's a very, very, very serious problem for them, and I'm not sure that they'll find something there. Because one of the reasons for this is not just that no any social class will support them, because social life in Russia, or social sphere in Russia, is very atomized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no, there are no any serious social classes in the, you know, classic terms in Russia. So you can depend on something that even doesn't exist.
Uh-huh.
So that is the question. They, of course, they can based on army or secret service, and we know some historical examples of such things.
We know how those end as well.
sometimes it go on very long for very long time. For instance, first Iranian Shah Riza, the founder, mm-hmm. the founder of the dynasty, he founded or based his rule on the army mm-hmm. and on secret service, mm-hmm. but then he found the support.
Mm-hmm.
Then he found the support. He drew the support from some groups of Iranian population. But I think it's impossible now, especially in recent economical conditions.
What? And I go back to the question I asked. What is today the source of Putin's power, and does he risk losing it right now? Because again, I pointed out these different possible sources, right? The bureaucratic command of the system, the role of the honest broker, the popularity with a broad section of society when Putin's numbers were up in the 70s and the 80s. He doesn't have that anymore, although he's still floating around 50, which is a, you know, it's a great number if you're the president of the United States or France, but it's not so great a number if you want to have an authoritarian regime. You got to be really popular. What is the source of his power? Is it control of the economy, as you suggested,
yes,
and control
yes.
of the commanding heights of the economy?
There are three, I think, sources of this power. First of all, of course, this huge money from the economical control. Secondly, it's weak, not very strong, but weak and passive support from army and police,
mm-hmm.
and of course, secret service. And thirdly, sure, it's a TV screen.
It's a TV screen.
TV screen. Yeah. But TV screen is itself is supported by the huge money from
yeah.
the economic support.
Yeah.
That is why I told you that the primary source, the most important source, is the full control on the heights of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, this thing, TV screen, or media, or whatever, official media, or semi-official media, it's a very, very, very strong player because he is a kind of substitute for a lack of ideology. That is, I think, the most weak side or dimension of Putin's regime, the lack of ideology. They cannot invent kind of new or old new, you know, new old
mm-hmm.
ideology for this regime. Authoritarian regime cannot exist without ideology
mm-hmm.
because you have to explain somehow for your citizen why things are going or moving this direction.
And why you should be in charge.
Yes.
And why you should be in charge. Well, the more I look at the machinations in the elite and the instability that appears to be in the elite, I think if Putin ever does get removed, it's going to be a palace coup. They're going to find another front man. You know, the collective Putin is going to find another front man. It's not. I don't think it's going to be as much a result as from pressure on the streets.
Just look at Egypt. Mm-hmm. Egypt is a very interesting case in this sense because they removed, I think, military.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, with the military.
Yes, military removed Mubarak, and they're still in power.
Yeah,
just change military to some kind of inner circle or mm-hmm. whoever in Kremlin, and you'll see the same situation. I cannot exclude the probability that Putin will be removed by the inner circle yeah. itself. And I think the most dangerous thing for Putin is not these demonstrations and protests and
yeah,
so on.
Exactly.
Now, personally for him, it's his own supporters or his own core rulers in mm-hmm. Kremlin.
Before I move on to the next, or before we move on to the next section, I'd like to throw one question out there. It might be off the wall, but because I think probably we've moved beyond this point. But is it possible for Russia to change and reform with Putin? Can Putin change and kind of get more in line with the mood of society and himself loosen up the system as other authoritarian leaders in history have done?
I'm not a prophet, and
no, of
I don't
not.
Know.
No, no,
I'm not. I know nearly nothing about psychology and so on. But I think it's my opinion. I think it's impossible. Mm-hmm. It's impossible because this man is ever was absolutely disconnected with the society, and he is. More disconnected, if it possible, it is possible now. And how he can just launch reforms and so on, if he even doesn't know what to do and what is Russian society, right. what parts what it consists
and
of.
He appears shockingly disconnected.
Yes, absolutely. He even sometimes it occurred to me that he even when all this propaganda meetings with. So-called plain people of Russia and so on. He even doesn't understand what he's asking for about. And that is the question. Yeah, he's like Marie Antoinette in some sense.
we won't go there. No, I tend to agree with you. My I thought there was a chance when he first decided to come back to the presidency. I thought maybe. And again, we discussed it on the podcast. I've written about it on the blog that maybe he would try to be, the benevolent authoritarian reformer of that type. And others have made this argument as well. But it looks like we've been beyond that point. In a few moments, we'll shift gears from this highly theoretical discussion and talk about a story that made headlines and lit up the Twitter sphere this week. Is Ksenia Sobchak, whose father, Anatoly Sobchak, helped launch Putin's political career, really about to be prosecuted for tax evasion? I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
I have the impression that this is an act of political reprisal and nothing else. And it is clear that it has nothing to do with the law.
That was socialite turned social activist Ksenia Sobchak after reports appeared in the media suggesting that she might be the subject of an investigation into her taxes and could face a prison term for alleged tax evasion. Until this month, it was assumed that Ksenia Sobchak enjoyed a degree of immunity despite her opposition activities. Her father, the late former St. Petersburg mayor Anatoly Sobchak, after all, helped launch Vladimir Putin's political career. But all that changed this month. On June 11th, agents from the investigative committee searched Sobchak's apartment as part of a criminal probe into street violence during demonstrations on May 6th. Demonstrations, incidentally, that Sobchak did not attend. A day later, on June 12th, exactly 13 years to the day after her father returned to Russia from exile in Paris, she was questioned by the investigative committee, which later announced that they found, during her apartment search, 1 million euros and $500,000 in cash. And this week, the pro-Kremlin daily Izvestia reported, citing unidentified Interior Ministry officials, that Sobchak faced a potential charges of tax evasion. The paper reported that Sobchak's 2011 tax declaration reported 6.7 million rubles, or about $210,000 in income. Sobchak didn't wait long to respond. She announced that she would sue Izvestia over the article, that the information about her tax return is incorrect, and that she paid every kopeck she owes in income tax. And in an article in Komsomolskaya Pravda, Sobchak accused the authorities of waging class warfare, stirring up hatred against her simply because she is rich, calling this irresponsible. After what happened in 1917, she wrote, "Inciting class hatred is no joke in this country. It's like putting matches in the hands of a child. Please smear me in some other way. For the sake of peace in our country, I promise I'll give you a lot of reasons." Nevertheless, Ilya Ponomarev, an opposition state Duma deputy from the center-left Adjust Russia, has asked Sobchak to distance herself from the protest movement. Kirill, a number of things appear to be going on here. The authorities appear to be trying to send a message. To Sobchak here. I still find it very, very hard to believe that they're going to create a martyr out of this woman who enjoys a very wide following, who has hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter, whose father helped launch Putin's political career. I seriously doubt they're going to try to prosecute her, but they do seem to be trying to send her some kind of a message to back off her opposition activities. And this also, there's another thing they're trying to do, is as Sobchak has suggested, they're trying to use her class and her wealth as a wedge issue to divide the opposition and to divide the opposition from society, which fits this populism we were talking about in the first half of the program. What's your take of this very strange incident that popped up in the news this week regarding Ksenia Sobchak?
Let's start from Ksenia Sobchak herself. Who is she? You're told she's a socialite, she's TV celebrity.
A former reality TV host.
Yes, okay. Yeah, Big Brother. Yeah, Dom Dva. Yeah, it's very interesting because many social and cultural and political problems, they focus on this figure. First of all, we just discussed the lack of ideology in Putin's authoritarian regime. And pop culture and especially TV pop culture is a kind of substitute for the ideology in this mm-hmm. regime. That's why it's absolutely important for the very existence. Pop culture is very important for the very existence of Putin's regime. And Ksenia Sobchak is one of the most major players of
this world.
Yes. That is why this thing is very important for the situation with if you look at all the context of Russian life, not just focusing on Ksenia Sobchak and her relationships with Putin, which is like, you know, Shakespeare play which is played on a celebrity show, right, and so on, but let's see all the context. Who is Sobchak? Sobchak is one of the most powerful and strong foundations or basis of the recent political, cultural, and social life in Russia, because the audience of this TV show, of which he hosted some months ago, they are not kind of intellectuals, mm-hmm. hipsters, or creative class. It's ordinary people. And in this case, when such people begin to rebelling, to rioting, mm-hmm. to be protesting against the Putin's regime and whoever, it's very serious, and I take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you can joke a lot about her clumsy attempts to be a political figure and so on. First of all, she's very clever.
She's very clever.
She's extremely clever. She's a good educated girl, woman, young woman, and thirdly, anyway, her social role is very important, mm-hmm. crucial for the recent regime in Russia. And when a plot in Russia, mm-hmm. in this world, this base, one of the most important bases of the regime, beginning to collapse, mm-hmm. Not just to collapse, just to revolting against all the right. system. The regime is becoming lame.
I'm smiling because mm-hmm. I'm actually reminded of an incident in American history during the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. When Walter Cronkite, who was just a very trusted news anchor on the television news, criticized President Johnson and criticized the Vietnam War for the first time on the air. And by legend, President Johnson was watching the news and said, good God, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost America. And you made me think Putin singing, good God, if I've lost Ksenia Sobchak, I've lost Russia. But maybe that's not too far from the truth.
Man, I don't know if he's watching, he watches TV.
Yeah, I don't know if he watches TV, but he knows what she's doing.
Yes, his secretary.
And this is somebody he knew from the time she was a very little girl.
Sure, and that is very important because, as I told you, pop culture is a substitute for ideology in modern Russia. It's very interesting because pop culture is not just kind of one of these Soviet things that was the legacy of USSR in modern post-Soviet Russia. Celebrity cult, like, you know, tax evasions, McDonald's, all these things, they had been brought from West.
Mm-hmm.
And this is and this is one of the most important gains.
We've only given you celebrity cults, tax evasion, and McDonald's?
Computer.
Anyway,
computers had been invented at the same time in Soviet Union and UK and United. So,
we didn't even give you computers.
So let's remember Sputnik and so on.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm joking. But speaking seriously, celebrity cult is a very important thing in modern Russia, because in the previous times, you know, during the Soviet period and so on, we had a kind of celebrity cult, but this was kind of semi unofficial celebrities, mm-hmm. like Vladimir Vysotsky, mm-hmm. and so on. You can see, you can watch a movie with Vladimir Vysotsky. At the same time, you listen to unofficial Vysotsky songs somewhere on Soviet Kuchnya, you know,
right.
Drinking vodka and so on. But now it's different. There are two different cultures, highbrow,
mm-hmm.
and lowbrow.
Mm-hmm.
And when highbrow or middlebrow culture begins to revolt against Putin, it's okay.
Right.
It's nothing dangerous for him.
Right.
But when this lowbrow mm-hmm. Culture begins to revolt against the regime, this is serious.
When you lose reality show stars, you're in deep trouble, is what you're saying. And this is not just a reality show star. This is a very, very clever and very popular reality show star. So how far do you think they'll push this? How far do they push this?
I don't know, really.
Because she is showing... I was wondering, when this story first broke, was she going to tone it down a bit? And she has shown no signs of doing that whatsoever. In fact, she's coming out even more aggressively now. How far do they push this? Do they dare prosecute her?
I don't know. On one hand, she has a huge audience.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I have no doubt. Her story does seem to check out. I mean, I don't think she filed a tax return saying she made $200,000. That seems kind of absurd to me. It's no secret that she makes a lot of money, and when you're at that level in Russia, you tend to be pretty careful about your taxes.
Yes, sure, but anyway.
So they'd have to really.
I don't want to discuss
the details. We don't know the details. We don't know the details, but I assume they would really have to fabricate.
It's a huge sum in cash, really. Yes, $1.5 million. It's a huge sum in cash, even in Russian terms.
But as she put it, you know, she does have the right to keep her money wherever she chooses.
Theoretically speaking, yes.
And she says she can't remember the last time she filed a tax return for less than the equivalent of $1 million.
Yeah. Anyway, but it's not a question of the theory,
how far do they push this?
I think she's not. What I can claim now, just now, that she's not stopping now.
Right.
And that is all. What it will be in future, I don't know. Mm. Maybe it will be some kind of compromise between her and
the authorities
and so on. Maybe Putin, he's becoming more and more obsessive with such things. He will go on with this thing, and it could be kind of Shakespearean drama, you know. It could be, I don't know really, because it depends on what will happen this autumn.
In the elections.
Yes, on, social reforms, protests, and so on. This is the first thing. And secondly, of course, it's very strange, but I think the most important factor here is oil prices.
Yes, and they're going down.
Yes, so in some sense, fate of Ksenia Sobchak is connected to oil prices. It's very interesting, but I'd prefer to be oil prices connected to fate of Ksenia Sobchak.
Personally, I don't think they're going to push this too far. I think what they're doing is they're trying to scare her and send a message to her. But I just don't see them pulling the trigger on something like this. The consequences are too grave, and we can't forget Putin's personal connection to her. I mean, this is somebody Putin knew since she was a little girl, right? But what I do think they're doing, and I alluded to this earlier, is playing this class card here, playing the class resentment card here. Part of this might have been an effort to get her to put out her real tax returns, because this is what she kind of has to do now to defend herself, right? And once she puts out her real tax – and this is why I brought up the issue of her money. Once she puts out her real tax returns, all of Russia is going to see just how much she makes. And this could be used against the opposition in terms to play this class resentment card among the working classes. So I think this might be part of an elaborate propaganda game that they're playing. Of course, we don't know, but that's what I seem to see happening right now.
I think that one of the most interesting sides of this celebrity cult in Russia, I don't know how it's in the United States, is that if you, just ordinary people, just obtaining information about the salaries or for the fortune of some kind of TV star and so on, you feel envy but not class hatred.
No, one of the differences is it's something you aspire to almost. I mean, I mean
envy in the positive way.
Yeah.
Not like a class hatred and so on. Envy, just I want to be like her.
Yeah.
In this sense. And so this card is not very good in this game against Sobchak.
Mm.
It's not about some kind of working class heroes who are struggling with some rich girl, Paris Hilton, and so on. It's about the very atomized, absolutely don't have any values, the society which doesn't have any values, and the only value in this society, in the most part of Russian society now, is money. Mm-hmm. Money is an object of envy,
mm-hmm.
but not an object of class hatred.
Yeah,
you know, it's absolutely.
So you think Russia's moved beyond this?
Yes. I think it's in Marx, Karl Marx's definition, class hatred or class war and just envy, social mm-hmm. envy, or you know, anyway, they're absolutely different things.
Right. Right.
And that is why I think Putin or his, you know, investigative committee and all these guys, they'll fail playing this game.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. And another thing we have to bear in mind is that the way the opposition-minded people have viewed Ksenia Sobchak has undergone a transformation throughout this whole period. If you remember correctly, when she appeared for the first time on the stage, I believe it was at Bolotnaya, if I'm not mistaken, she was booed. She was booed. But now she's not being booed. Now she seemed to have earned the respect of the opposition protesters, and we'll see if they rush to her defense. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have today. I'd like to remind you that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Thanks for a great discussion, Kirill.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank a key unsung member of the Power Vertical podcast team, our very awesome producer, Tanya Koncheva, who always makes Kirill and I sound much better than we really are. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter @PowerVertical. Join us again next week. I'd like to just let everybody know that Kirill will be on a much-deserved vacation. But Mark Galliotti of New York University, somebody well-known to Power Vertical podcast listeners, has graciously agreed to co-host. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.